Well, good morning to everybody. We are in Matthew chapter 24, 25, and looking at these discourses of Jesus. Again, we could spend a whole lot more time looking at these things more in depth, but we're kind of still doing somewhat of an overview, so it's tempting to get bogged down. I'm going to try not to do that as we press on here, but I think it'll be helpful to us to look at how chapters 23, 24, and 25 all fit together as we can draw all of this to some conclusion today, hopefully. Chapter 25 has some parables of watchfulness in them. And the point I would like to emphasize more than anything is to keep those connected with chapter 24 that we remember. People are the one to put these chapter divisions here, and we, I think, psychologically tend to separate things by chapters when sometimes that may not be the best idea. Now, before I continue, there still have a few of these short commentary on Matthew 24. If anyone doesn't have one, would like one, they're already printed up, so... Again, I don't plan on going through this in any detailed fashion, but you can have it for your reference somewhat. I thought what I might do, actually, is go over to Luke a little bit here, because what Matthew tends to do, it seems to me, is collect the teaching of Jesus and group it together. For example, the parables of Jesus that you find are mostly gathered together in chapter 13 in Matthew's gospel. And I presume that Jesus did a lot of teaching about this coming day of judgment against Jerusalem on several different occasions, because in Luke, his teaching is kind of scattered out here and there. And again, Matthew has collected it together for us, primarily there in chapter 24 of Matthew. That's not to say Jesus didn't say all of those things on that occasion. I just think, like a lot of preachers, you know, you preach the same lesson, make the same points on several different occasions. And so it shows that Jesus was teaching on these things on many occasions. First of all, let's notice in Luke chapter 17... And you'll recognize a lot of this language that we've already looked at in Matthew 24. Luke chapter 17, verse 22, "The days will come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. They will say to you, 'Look there, look here.' Do not go away, do not run after them. For just like the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky, shines to the other part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, drinking, marrying, given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and flood came and destroyed them all." It was the same as happened in the days of Lot, basically. And so, verse 30, "it will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed." So there will be a sudden judgment that comes. Some, you know, people are going to be going about their daily lives and thinking this day is the same as every other day, and find out that, lo and behold, there is judgment coming unexpectedly upon them. Well, there are some who, however, can be watching and be expecting judgment, those who are forewarned, and that's the whole point of Jesus warning his disciples. Here, verse 31, "On that day, the one who's on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. And likewise, the one who's in the field must not turn back." You know, it's kind of like when you fly, they always tell you, you know, if there's an emergency, don't take your stuff with you, you know, just leave it behind. Well, there's this tendency we have to want to grab our stuff, you know. And so Lot's wife is given as an example of this undue attachment to our worldly things. Notice verse 34, "On that night there will be two in one bed, one will be taken, the other left. two women grinding in the same place, one taken and the other left. Verse 36, which is in some manuscripts, not in others, two men in the field, one taken and the other left. And then finally Jesus says, where the body is, there also the vultures or the eagles will be gathered. Well, this is all language of judgment again. And most people in the religious world, how do they understand verses 34 through 36? So one is taken and the other is left.
Well, this is usually what they term the rapture. That's going to be some miraculous. You're going to be standing there talking to somebody and poof, they're going to be gone.
Okay.
If you're left.
Yeah, that's the most common way people read this, that there will be two women grinding their wheat into flour, and suddenly one's going to be gone and one's going to be left. And who's the lucky one? Yeah, the person that's taken, right? Well, if you understand that this is in the context of the coming judgment of God against Jerusalem and the form of the Roman army who's going to execute that historical judgment, who's the lucky one? The one that's left. You know, the one that's taken is not the one that's favored. So it puts an entirely different look on that. Well, I just want you to keep that in the back of your mind, what we just read in chapter 17.
And why do you say that that's the unlucky one?
Well, you know, it's a term that's often used for, you know, death or destruction or killing, to take up or to take away. Now, it's also used in positive ways, too. I'm not saying just on the basis of that word itself, but in the context of what's going on here, that seems to me to more likely way to understand the, it is a parable of sorts, I guess you might say.
Yeah, I mean, if you're dealing with the fact that an army is going to come in and take you over, and some of you are going to be taken into captivity, some of you will be left behind, and I guess it's just speaking of soldiers' discretion as far as when they come in, who they're going to take captive with them, and who they're not. Obviously, that it's usually not a pleasant thing to be taken captive by a foreign army.
Right. And I don't think Jesus is saying it's going to be 50-50 either, necessarily, that make some to-do out of the two versus, you know, the one. Now let's look at chapter 19. Here's another little section, and this gives you an appreciation for how Luke goes about addressing this same issue. Luke chapter 19, beginning in verse 41, when he approached the city of Jerusalem, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, if you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes, for the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And again, that sounds very much like what happens in AD 70, where the Roman army comes and besieges the nation. And here again, it's to be understood that this is a divine visitation. You know, this is that word that's commonly used in the Old Testament to talk about God entering in, bringing a day of judgment against the enemies of God, and a day of vindication and deliverance for his people. And then chapter 21 is the one that most more fully corresponds with Matthew chapter 24. And we've already noted verse 20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her destruction is near. And that's a helpful verse, we remember, because in Matthew and Mark, they both record Jesus' words as saying, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy location, then you know that's the sign that he's giving to them, that this judgment he's spoken of, when the temple is not going to be left one stone upon another and all of that, that's your sign. Well, I don't know whether Jesus, you know, this is one of those things it's interesting to ponder. Did Jesus actually say to them very pointedly, I'm talking about an army surrounding Jerusalem, on that occasion in Matthew 24, Or is this kind of Luke's divine interpretation? You understand what I mean? You know, Jesus could have used the word saying, when you see the abomination of desolation, and then when Luke gives it to us, he gives us the meaning of that, which is when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. But I suspect, again, Jesus on many occasions taught these things, and so by comparing them and putting them together, we can easily figure out what these things are talking about. And so as he goes on, as he does in Matthew 24, those that are in Judea should flee to the mountains. If you're in the city, get out. You know, you can escape this judgment because it's not the end of the world. It's not, you know, some kind of worldwide conclusion of the end of time and all of that. This is a historical judgment of the Roman army coming against Jerusalem, and you can know when it's time to get out of town and save yourself. And so that's what they're encouraged to do. Well, I just again wanted to point out some of those things in Luke to help give us some point of comparison, I guess you might say, with Matthew chapter 24. So let's go back to chapter 24 now. And give Brian. Now, the first thing I would like to, we talked about this point that Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, then those that are in Judea ought to flee. And we even get this little statement in verse 15 of Matthew 24, let the reader understand, which is, I would presume, the writer of the gospel's little side note to the reader. Because this hasn't happened yet, you pay particular attention to this because it applies to you very directly. And it also may indicate that Matthew's gospel was more written to people in that area. You know, if the gospel was written for people living in France, I don't know it would be of great help to them to say, oh, when you see that Roman army in Jerusalem, get out of Judea. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. But if the gospel of Matthew was written primarily to people in the region, then it would be very important for them to understand when it happens in their lifetime, they need to act quickly and to avoid getting caught up in the destruction. And again, the Roman church historian Eusebius says that the Christians did leave the city of Jerusalem in that little window of opportunity we talked about and fled to the city of Pella in particular. And so this is the sign, again, that Jesus has given to them. When you see this, this is when you know it's going to happen and you know to leave. Well, here's the interesting question to me. Wouldn't any Jew, when he sees the Roman army encircling Jerusalem, know it's time to get out of town? You know, if the Roman army encircled Jerusalem and then had to withdraw, you would say, honey, let's pack our bags. We're leaving. We're not going to mess around with this. Wouldn't that be obvious to them?
Well, I think the zealots would have said, we've done it.
Okay. All right. I think that's precisely the idea.
If the Roman army was leaving, they could have said, oh, well, that's done with.
Right. And now, and what would they attribute it to, do you think?
God has given them the victory.
Okay. You think about all those stories in the Old Testament, like Gideon, who was able to defeat, you know, he was vastly outnumbered. You guys have 300 guys. Well, God, with one person, makes a majority. This is evidence. This is proof of how God is with us. And so these people are really deluded into thinking they're living in a special time in which God is going to usher in his messianic kingdom, Messiah like they were expecting, which was some kind of military deliverer. And they're going to beat the Romans. And all those passages in the Old Testament that predicted the Jews are going to rule the world and defeat all the nations of the earth and all of that was on the verge of coming true. And all those years of oppression and foreign occupation were finally going to pay off. The light at the end of the tunnel can be seen and all of that. And probably the best proof of this is even after the Roman army comes back, the 10th Legion comes back to besiege Jerusalem. And It's about Passover when the siege really sets in earnest. The city is completely encircled. All of the bulwarks have been built by the Romans. I mean, it is clearly a city under siege. And people are coming for Passover to Jerusalem. And what do you think the Roman general Titus does? He says, go right on in. Go right on into Jerusalem. Because the more people that get in there, the quicker the water and the food's going to be consumed, and the more rats in the trap, you know, and it's going to be a slaughter.
I think Josephus says there were 1 million killed, 97,000 captured.
Yeah, 1.1 million. And that number is probably high to me, but Tacitus, the Roman historian, says 500,000 or 600,000. So somewhere in that, it does seem an extraordinary number. And, you know, any more when there's an earthquake and kills 30,000 people, we think, oh, that's horrible. Or a tsunami kills 250,000. And that is staggering. I can't hardly conceive of that many people dying in one catastrophe. But you're talking a man-made catastrophe that could very well be at least double that. So it is a horrible thing. But that, of course, is probably something of an object lesson of just how much God's judgment was being poured out upon the city of Jerusalem. And it's kind of like the Hebrew writer said. We're actually going to talk about this in the sermon this morning. You know, the Hebrew writer often makes a comparison. If those who heard the message delivered by angels didn't listen to it, how much more so we ought to listen to that which God has spoken through His Son. Or if people couldn't escape punishment for violating the old covenant, what do you think is going to happen to those that violate the new covenant? Well, in the same way, if you see all the judgments God brought against His people in the Old Testament for idolatry, for rejecting the message of the prophets, what kind of judgment do you think is in store for those who will put to death the Messiah and reject the ultimate prophet and so on? And so it is a horrible, catastrophic judgment. It is far worse than what happened in the Old Testament, corresponding to the worst crime, I guess you might say, that they're guilty of. So the Jews thought they're going to win this war against Rome. The Christians, listening to the teaching of Jesus and the disciples, as Matthew and the others wrote these things down, knew, no, this is judgment of God against the nation. Get out of town and escape while we can. Once again, this is not about the end of the world. It's something that's going to happen during the lifetime of this generation. And again, historically, we see that's exactly what happened. There are a lot of things here we could look at. One thing I want to note particularly, verse 36, of course, verse 34 is the one that says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will not pass away. It's certain it's going to happen. And then verse 36 says, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. And when I was growing up, I heard almost universally everybody explain this, and probably in a group this size, there may very well be people to hold this view, so I don't mean to be unkind or, you know, I did grow up looking at it this way and came to understand later that's probably not the best explanation. But the way it was explained to me was, the disciples really are asking two questions. When is the temple going to be destroyed, and when is the world going to end? And so Jesus answers these two different questions. The disciples may have thought they were the same question, but Jesus knows they're not the same question. And so in AD 70, the temple's going to be destroyed by the Romans, but the end of the world's going to be a long time later. And so verse 36, of that day and hour, and so they would say, well, now see, Jesus here is changing the topic. He's saying, okay, I finished talking about what's going to happen during the time of this generation, but now let me answer your other question. Of that day and hour, nobody knows when it's going to happen. So at this point, Jesus then starts talking about the final day of judgment and the end of the world and so on. Well, one of the things I would point out to you is, again, immediately following that, the coming of the Son of Man will be like in the days of Noah. and marrying and giving in marriage and eating and drinking and so on. There will be two men in the field, one taken and one left, two women grinding at the mill, one taken and one left. So you need to watch out because you don't know when the Lord's coming. Well, again, in Luke, clearly that language Jesus was using there was in regard to what? Destruction of Jerusalem. That was clear in the context of Luke. Here that's been put after verse 36. And while obviously that same image could be used for any judgment of God, you know, God's judgment could always be said to come like a thief in the night or suddenly and unexpectedly and so on. The fact that Luke uses that explicitly in regard to the destruction of Jerusalem, and Matthew has collected all this other material on the destruction of Jerusalem together, it seems to me likely that we're still talking about this destruction of Jerusalem in this final judgment against, or historical judgment against, the Jerusalem of that day. And so I would continue to read, even after verse 36, in the context of God's coming judgment against Jerusalem. But now here's the problem with that, is once you get past verse 36, there's really no stopping place. You know, because we just go from one parable to another. So verse 42 really starts this theme of watchfulness. Be on the alert, because you don't know which day your Lord is coming. The Son of Man is coming in an hour when you do not think he will. Verse 44. Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom the master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? You know, the master goes off and he leaves his slave in charge. Is he going to be a good slave or a bad slave? Well, the evil slave says, verse 48, my master's not coming for a long time. Begins to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards. And the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect, in an hour which he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, and there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And, of course, the good servant will be watchful and expect his Lord to return at any time, and whether he returns today or next week or next year or 10 years from now, he's still going to do what he's supposed to do because he's going to do the right thing. But then again, ignore the chapter division. We start in chapter 25. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. And 5 were foolish and 5 were wise. 5 made preparation to be able to endure the period of waiting. And this parable is based upon, again, this principle of you don't know exactly when things are going to happen. This, we don't appreciate this as much in our own culture because we have timepieces that keep time pretty precisely. And so when we say we're going to start at 9 o'clock, we start pretty much at 9 o'clock. And there are a lot of brethren, if it's 9:01, they're starting to turn purple and their veins are popping out, you know, because we said 9 and we'd be liars if we'd start at 9:01. Well, it's kind of interesting how people are about time, because if we had an atomic clock that calculated it down to nanoseconds and we were 1 nanosecond late starting, would we be lying to everybody then? Oh, no, that's silly. 1 nanosecond, you know. Well, why is a nanosecond silly but a minute isn't, you know? And it's all cultural. But if you live in a time where you tell time by looking at the sun and kind of saying, well, that's about where the sun is, it's about this time of day, you know, trying to calculate things down to a nanosecond would be really silly. But even minutes would be about as absurd to them. And so things like, you know, when is the bridegroom going to show up with his bride? You know, you can have a vague idea. It's going to be today sometime. But it's not like we would today where, you know, okay, the wedding's going to take place at 1:30. We expect by 2 o'clock it's going to be over. You know, something like that. Those things were vaguely defined. And so, once again, you're waiting, not knowing exactly the precise time, so that you can't cut it that close. What you have to do is simply be prepared and waiting in this context, because this is the respectful thing to do. It would be disrespectful not to be there.
Now, are you, the scriptures that we're reading here, the ones just preceding chapter 25 and then rolling, you know, into 25, same line of thought, are we
Well, that's a good question. And my answer to that basically is, and especially when you get to the end of chapter 25, where there's a judgment scene of the gathering of the nations before God's throne, the separating them, the sheep and the goats, the right and the left, and passing judgment on them, you know, that you say, well, that sounds very much like a final day of judgment, you know. And these parables of watchfulness, the parable of the talents and the ten virgins, sound similar likewise. Well, my point to all of that would be, we clearly are living 2,000 years after the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Why do we need to even know anything about Matthew chapter 24 if that was what it was about? Why don't we just cut it out of our Bible and never bother about reading it, because it doesn't apply to me. I don't need to worry about escaping Judea and fleeing to the mountains. I don't need to worry about seeing a Roman army encircling Jerusalem and knowing to get out of town. So it's pointless to me. It has no application. Well, that would be like reading the book of Genesis and saying, well, I didn't live in the time of Abraham. What's that got to do with me? Or I didn't live in the time of the Exodus. What's that have to do with me? Or I didn't live in the time of the kings. Why should I study 1 and 2 Kings? Well, even though we may identify historical context in which Scripture applies and relates to precisely, all of it, of course, has some application to our lives. There are principles we learn from all of this. It would be like saying, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, there was that man that was living with his father's wife. Well, we're not in Corinth. We're not the church at Corinth. Why are we reading their mail? That happened 2,000 years ago, way across the ocean. We understand that we don't have that particular individual in our congregation and have to deal with him, but if we had someone in a similar situation, you would have to deal with his similar sin in a similar way, because the principle of truth will apply in a similar fashion. And that's a principle we see established in Scripture time and again. You know, Jesus says, rightly did Isaiah speak of you. And he quotes from Isaiah chapter 29, you know, this people who teach for, doctrine, the commandments of men, you know. Well, was Isaiah really predicting in the future and saying, you know, 700 years from now, there are going to be some people that are trying to take their human opinions and make them into God's law? Well, of course, he was talking to people of his own day, but what Jesus was saying was, you know, this principle from the time of Isaiah just as surely applies to you. And we would read that passage today, and a preacher would get up today and say, you know, Isaiah's talking about you. And, well, he was, in a sense, but not specifically and directly, but by principle, by application. And I think in the same way, we need to understand this with Matthew 24. In the context of the coming judgment of God against Jerusalem, how will those Christians be watchful? Well, they need to be prepared for this judgment that's going to come in their generation. They need to be like the wise virgins. They need to be like the people that use their talents to serve God and so on. But after that judgment has passed, instead of just saying, well, let's just pitch that out of the Bible now, we say, well, in the same way that we learn from God's judgment against the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians and all those other people in the Old Testament, and this judgment of God against Jerusalem in the New Testament, all of these are models of the final judgment. And so it is appropriate to take the principles that we learn here and apply them to a judgment that we all will face eventually someday.
it would seem kind of strange that Jesus gives all the signs. This is what you need to look for. This is what's going to happen. When this happens, boom, 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 you need to get out. Get gone. And then, if it was the same event for him to turn around and say, well, nobody knows when it's going to happen, not even me. How in the world could Jesus describe exactly what's going to happen and know that this is when the destruction of Jerusalem is going to happen, when you see this, this, and this, and this? If he doesn't know when it's going to be.
Right.
So
right.
It seems, I have a tough time not separating that into two different situations right. that he's talking about.
Well, and that's a valid point, and that's often made to illustrate the difference between the two. My reconciling of that is that I do see a difference between saying, and again, if you go back to Luke, you can see this point being made by Jesus. Luke chapter 21 and verse 29. Well, it's also back in Matthew 24. I thought it was, but it's a little more extensive in Luke. Behold, the fig tree and its leaves, as soon as it puts forth leaves, you know for yourself summer is near. When you see these things happening, recognize the kingdom of God is near. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And then, again, in Luke's context, he doesn't include that statement, no one knows the day or the hour here. Heaven and earth will pass away, and my word will not pass away. Be on your guard, so your hearts will not be weighted down with dissipation, drunkenness, and that day will not come on you suddenly like a trap, for it will come upon all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Keep alert at all times, that you may have strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. And so how I would reconcile that is, as Jesus says, when you look at the fig tree, you know, it's about summertime. You can tell what season it is, I guess you might say. You know, the general time period. That a Christian would be able to look at what's happening, and the Jews have rebelled against the Romans, and the Romans have come and made an initial attempt to put this thing down and were rebuffed. And the Christian says, well, this is the time in which we live. But he doesn't know the exact day. You know, it's like, okay, it's going to be June 13th. I'm going to wait till June the 12th to pack and leave town. So I would understand the specific day to mean don't try to cut it close. Don't try to think you know the time so precisely that you can try to stay as long as you can and then leave. But you know generally what the season is, but you don't know the exact time. And so you still have to be watchful and prepared. But that's, again, how I've, one possible way of reconciling
that. Well, as you said, that even when it must have taken days for Titus to assemble the Roman army around the city, and then to allow some of the Jews even into the city, this must have gone on for days.
Yeah.
So a specific day when the city was finally closed down, nobody knew that.
Right. But again, I would, and another perspective I come from this is, in the Old Testament, when we find prophecies given, for example, we've talked a good bit about the Davidic promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that God was going to raise up this descendant of David to sit on David's throne, I will be his father, he'll be my son, and so on. And instead of seeing that as a prediction of somebody who's going to come in the future, 1,000 years in the future, there's going to be this Jesus of Nazareth who's going to be the son of David who's going to sit on David's throne. Clearly, how the Old Testament understood that was Solomon was a son of David who sat on David's throne and in some sense fulfilled that prophecy. All of the kings of Judah fulfilled that prophecy in some sense. But only Jesus is the true ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy. And again, it's this principle of types and shadows and models. And I like to use that illustration of, you know, a model. Well, it's just like the real thing in some ways, but it's also inadequate in other ways. And I think what we have here is a model of final judgment. And so it is appropriate to look at Matthew 23, 24, and 25, even though historically it applies to a specific historical judgment of God against Jerusalem, we say, well, what's the lesson for me? Well, there are all kinds of principles of final judgment we can derive from these chapters. Now, the problem I would have is if one wanted to say, okay, the moon will not give its light in verse 29. Well, is that going to be an actual physical event at the end of time? Well, it may very well be. That prophecy may be literally fulfilled in the final end. But I do know that that's a figure that's used throughout the prophets to talk about God's judgment against his people. And so I don't know that I would look for details of some of these things that historically were applying to the destruction of Jerusalem and say, well, that's what's going to happen at the end. I don't know if I'm being clear about that, but Joy. Well, that's true. That's what makes it difficult to unwind some of this sometimes. And since our time's running out here, let me say kind of to help wrap this up somewhat, that it certainly does sound like final judgment. I'd be the first one to say that. But again, I think that's intentional. All of the judgments of God in the Bible sound like final judgment. Even though historically we may know this was the judgment against the Babylonians. So you read Isaiah chapter 13 and 14. Isaiah comes out and tells you this is an oracle against Babylon. And there was a historical Babylonian empire that came under God's judgment, and he brought them down, and he wanted everybody to understand, although it may look on the surface like the Persians got an army together and beat the Babylonians, what you really need to know is that God did this. Behind the scenes, it's really a spiritual judgment of God against wickedness. But when God expresses that judgment, it's given in a, again, the sounds like the final judgment. And I think part of the lesson here is that, mundane, ordinary language really can't adequately describe the judgment of God. That is, the prophet could simply say, the Persians are going to come and beat the Babylonians. And that would be a prediction, and it would be historically accurate and so on. But if what you're really trying to say is, you need to understand the cosmic picture here. You need to understand what's going on in the real realm that matters. This physical realm is not the realm that matters. What really matters is what's going on in the spiritual realm, and there's this great battle between good and evil, and God is bringing this great, horrible judgment against wickedness, and so it uses very grand language to describe that. And that's why we get some of this kind of graphic symbolism and figures that are used to try to describe that. Saying the sun's going to be darkened and the moon's not going to shine and the stars going to fall out of the sky, that just has a way of grasping, getting closer to the truth, so to speak, than simply saying, oh, the Roman army is going to come and destroy the city of Jerusalem, or it's going to burn the temple. You know, that just sounds too mundane. It doesn't really get to the real point, I guess.
Did that type of stuff happen on the night Jesus was crucified? Didn't the sun go dark early?
Well, certainly there was the 3 hours of darkness, literally, on that occasion. And again, I think
some of that.
Yeah, you know, sometimes we do see some of that. And some have suggested that the Passover moon, which would have been a full moon, would have been a blood red moon, you know, things like that. So, all right, well, next week we will, and we'll leave Matthew behind here. We're going to look at the last discourse we're going to look at is in John chapter 13 at the end, beginning about verse 31 or so is where we'll pick up and run through chapter 17. And so we'll take a few weeks to look at all of that. But you want to go ahead and be reading that. You'll be ready for... this is a unique discourse in the Gospel of John, and that'll cover the primary major discourses of Jesus, which we're looking at in this class period.